there. Today is Thursday, June 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Russian hacking hearings get underway in Washington. The U.S. urges China to take action against North Korea.
North Korea has engaged in a number of criminal enterprises that help fund its weapons programs.
Islam in America, an immigrant tells his story. Also ahead, a new documentary on the career of a multi-Grammy-winning rapper. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Congress continued its look into Russian meddling in last year's presidential election campaign with two hearings Wednesday, one in the Senate, one in the House of Representatives. U.S. officials told lawmakers Wednesday there is no question that Russia engaged in widespread interference in last year's presidential election aimed at helping real estate mogul Donald Trump win the White House. But they said there's no evidence that Moscow was able to change the vote count. Former Homeland Security Agency Chief Jay Johnson said at a House Intelligence Committee hearing that the extent of Russian hacking into computer files at the Democratic Party headquarters in Washington and attempts to infiltrate state elections records went significantly beyond past Russian efforts to influence U.S. elections.
When I say that this effort was unprecedented, what I mean is that we not only saw infiltrations, but we saw efforts to dump information into the public space for the purpose of influencing the ongoing political campaign. And it was widespread. And in that respect, and we knew it was happening. So in that respect, it was very much unprecedented.
Lawmakers remain divided over the question of whether President Trump may have taken steps to obstruct justice in the Russia probe, an issue that reportedly has become a focus of the special counsel investigation led by former FBI Director Robert Mueller. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
This next round of congressional hearings will focus on the full scope of Russia's efforts to interfere with last year's U.S. presidential election. But one key issue that remains unresolved is whether President Trump himself is under investigation for possible obstruction of justice in connection with the Russia probe. A presidential tweet late last week seemed to confirm news reports that Trump is now a subject of the investigation, with the president adding that he's a victim of a witch hunt. One of the president's lawyers, Jay Sekulow, denied that and said the White House has not received any official confirmation that Trump is under investigation. Earlier this month, former FBI Director James Comey told the Senate Intelligence Committee that the president said, "I hope you can let this go," referring to the FBI's probe of Trump's fired former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Comey said it felt like a presidential directive.
I don't think it's for me to say whether the conversation I had with the president was an effort to obstruct. I took it as a very disturbing thing, very concerning.
Trump has denied Comey's account of their conversation about Flynn.
I didn't say that. I mean, I will tell you, I didn't say that.
And did he ask you to pledge his
loyalty? And there'd be nothing wrong if I did say it, according to everybody that I've read today, but I did not say that.
Legal analysts are divided over whether there is sufficient evidence so far to suggest obstruction of justice, says Paul Schiff Berman.
My guess is that by and large, people in Congress and others will believe Comey's testimony. The question will be whether they think Comey's testimony proves or suggests obstruction of justice.
Some Republicans have come to the president's defense, including Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Richard Burr, who had this exchange with Comey.
Did the president at any time ask you to stop the FBI investigation into Russian involvement in the 2016 U.S. elections?
Not to my understanding, no.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller has not spoken publicly about the investigation or whether Trump is a focus. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the United States continues to push China to rein in the Kim Jong-un regime in North Korea. Speaking during high-level security talks Wednesday, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urged his Chinese counterparts to step up diplomatic and economic pressure on the reclusive North Korean regime.
China understands that the United States regards North Korea as our top security threat. We reiterated to China that they have a diplomatic responsibility to exert much greater economic and diplomatic pressure on the regime if they want to prevent further escalation in the region.
But defense analysts said Washington may have to lower its expectations due to Beijing's strategic relationship with Pyongyang. Meanwhile, the first summit between South Korean President Moon Jae-in and U.S. President Donald Trump will be held next week. It comes in the wake of the death of Otto Warmbier, the U.S. student who had been held prisoner in North Korea for nearly 18 months and was medically evacuated last week in a coma. Both leaders are expected to emphasize the common threat of the repressive and nuclear-armed Kim Jong-un regime when they meet in Washington. But Brian Padden in Seoul reports increasing differences over security and trade could undermine the show of unity.
Both leaders in Washington and Seoul cite Warmbier's brutal treatment by the North Korean government as further reason to halt Pyongyang's rapidly advancing nuclear and ballistic missile program. But the two allies seem at odds on how to make that happen. The Trump administration has prioritized the short term, preventing North Korea from developing a nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missile that can strike the U.S. mainland. Washington has stressed the threat of military force and economic pressure from China, Pyongyang's key trading partner, but Trump has now expressed disappointment that Beijing's efforts have not worked. The progressive South Korean leader wants to balance military deterrence and sanctions with dialogue and engagement to ease tensions over time.
So I believe what Kim Jong-un would want the most is to have a security guarantee for his regime.
Moon's outreach proposals may not be well received in Washington, especially after Trump's hardline policies have been endorsed by Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
It would almost invite a type of reaction from President Trump that would look more at why South Korea is not towing a certain type of line that they're already seeing vis-a-vis the U.S.-Japan relationship.
Moon's decision to delay the full deployment of the U.S. THAAD missile defense system, citing the need to conduct an environmental study, has also raised concerns in Washington. However, many see this move as a way to accommodate China's opposition to the American advanced weapon deployment near its border. Trump has also threatened to terminate the U.S.-South Korea free trade agreement that produced a bilateral U.S. deficit of over $27 billion last year. Business leaders in Seoul advised the South Korean president to propose a $10 billion Buy American fund to boost imports of U.S. oil and other products that Trump can boast about on Twitter.
His tweets form an important part of the policy directives and the overall environment of the U.S. political and economic scene. So President Moon should plan in advance what he wants Mr. Trump to tweet.
Moon will likely emphasize that South Korean companies like Hyundai have built factories in the U.S. that employ 45,000 people and contributed $138 billion to the U.S. economy. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. says Gulf states have prepared a list of demands for Qatar. Russia cancels talks with the U.S. after new sanctions. The Islamic State blows up a historic Mosul mosque. And pop stars release a song to raise funds for London fire victims. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And we want you to learn more about the battle for Mosul from VOA's reporters on the ground in a multimedia special report at voanews.com. And turning now to what's trending on social media, Andrew Palchewski joins us. Hey, Andrew, so what are people posting and tweeting about today?
There was a gentleman down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, which is a nice beach town where a lot of people do vacationing here in the U.S. And this man was on vacation. He was on his hotel room balcony, and he saw people on the street below, and they appeared to be dancing. So he said, let me film this on Facebook Live, because he thought it might be a viral flash mob or a party going on. Well, it turns out it was actually a fight, and he figured this out pretty quickly when people began shooting, and he captured it on Facebook Live. Now, thankfully, nobody was killed. There were a few people that were injured, but they were not seriously injured, and they were able to apprehend the man who did the shooting. But certainly in for a surprise, people who turned into the Facebook Live there and thought they would see a party, and instead they saw a shooting. Certainly the man who shot it was a bit of a surprise. But this is what happens these days. We see these events pop up again and again on social media, on live streaming. As they happen, it really is a live platform. So this was the case down in Myrtle Beach.
Crazy.
It was. Not what you expect when you're on vacation and thinking you're going to see a party going on, and instead you see this. So
yeah,
exactly. Bit of a surprise for that guy.
Wow. Do you have any happy news from the world of social media?
I do. Snapchat has announced the Snap Map. That's a new way that you can find friends and family and see what they're up to on Snapchat. So when you go into Snapchat, you go to the camera screen, you kind of pinch outward, and that's how you get to this map where you can tag yourself, you can use emojis, little bitmojis, so you can have yourself doing anything from dancing, actual dancing, to listening to music, to eating, whatever you can imagine. You can tag that on the map and have people see that and see what you're up to. So Snap fans generally seem to be loving this. It's a trending topic on social media. Many of them are still waiting for their friends to discover this and start using it. So there are some photos of some very lonely Snap Map users with their one little bitmoji hanging out there on the map. But people think it's very cool so far, and they seem to be liking it. However, people are wondering if it could be used for some negative reasons, if you're trying to stalk people or figure out where people are. So there's some concern about that, putting your location out there publicly, although that's something that you run the risk of with any social network. And then there are a lot of people with roughly the same idea and varying wording. How long until Instagram copies this? Of course, we've talked about time and time again on the show how Snapchat has been copied in a number of different ways by Facebook and Instagram. Mm-hmm. Of course, mm-hmm. Facebook owns Instagram, from the different filters to the disappearing stories. So they're saying that it won't be before long that we see Instagram come up with a map feature and see people using that on Instagram. So we'll see if that is indeed the case, if they do copy Snapchat. But for now, Snapchat and Snap Map are the way that you can tag yourself and see where your friends are.
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, Muslims around the world and here in the United States are observing Islam's holy month. Ramadan is a time to reflect, reflection, honoring the first revelation of the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad. It's also a month of fasting, during which Muslims abstain from food and drink from sunrise to sunset. Virginia journalism professor Shahan Mufti is a Muslim American, a Pakistani immigrant, and an author who wrote the book that was chosen now as a common reading for an entire campus for the upcoming school year. He joins us now for more on why his book, which was published back in 2013, is especially relevant now in this current political climate.
The book is titled The Faithful Scribe, and the subtitle is This: A Story of Islam, Pakistan, Family, and War. And really those four things capture the major themes of the book. The book is built on years of reporting. I worked as a daily news reporter, and I was reporting for an American newspaper from Pakistan for many years after 2006. This was a really tumultuous time in Pakistan politically. So Pakistan was the stuff of page one news frequently during that time. So the book is, and it's built on that stuff, and it really tries to relay the very complex reality of that country to Americans that I was doing through daily news, but really needed a bigger canvas for the real story. There's another thread in the book, which is in which I really am following a history of my own family. Both my parents are from Pakistan, and I'm following the kind of the history of my family trees and tracing those to explore a larger history of Pakistan, kind of like the people's history of Pakistan and how the country came to be through the stories of individuals who happen to be members of my family and how Islam and political Islam fits into the national project, but also into the lives of the people, like my family.
Well, it certainly is relevant in the current political climate. I would imagine that's one of the reasons the book was chosen.
Absolutely, yes. Pakistan, interestingly, has, in the last few years, kind of receded from the headlines. It is obviously still an extremely important country for American policymakers and to all Americans, and still, you know, a country that people pay attention to, but it's not the same way that it was many years ago. But it is really the story of, there are, like I said, there are other themes in the book which make it very relevant. The theme of political Islam, so this book came out right around the time that the Arab Spring was beginning to unfold in a lot of Middle Eastern countries and Arab countries. And the question of, in our conversations about political Islam, really took a, they took a turn, but they really became much more pressing than they had ever been with the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and other countries. And Pakistan happens to be the first Islamic democracy that ever appeared on the map. When Pakistan appeared on the map in 1947, after World War II, at the same, or exactly around the same time that Israel came on the map as a state for the Jewish people, Pakistan came on the map as a country for the Muslims of mostly South Asia. And so Pakistan became that first country that really experimented with, it called itself a democracy, but it also had passed an Islamic constitution and called itself the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. So it became the first country in 1947 to experiment with Islam and democracy and really trying to see what political Islam in the modern world looks like. And that experiment gives Pakistan an importance that I think is beyond the headline. And that's a conversation that's really with the rise of the Islamic State and now, and some really terrible realities of what we're seeing of some really terrible experiments in Islam and political life. And then, of course, the story is also, my story is also the story of an immigrant family, a Muslim immigrant family to the United States from Pakistan. Both my parents are Muslims from Pakistan. I belong to a Muslim immigrant family. And a lot of the book, I trace my own history in the United States and that of my parents and their arrival in the United States from Pakistan, them fleeing Pakistan in the 1970s to come to the United States to build themselves a new life.
What do you think people can learn about the Muslim faith that they might have maybe not really understood given the current political climate?
Well, I think what my book really provides is a very intimate picture of living Islam is, Muslim life in America. And obviously I'm covering the period of the 19, all the way from the 1970s when my parents arrived in the United States all the way to the present moment where I am, Pakistani Muslim living in America. In the book, I call myself 100% American and 100% Pakistani. And that's the same, I would say, that same thing, is I'm 100% Western and 100% Muslim in that way as well.
All right. That's University of Richmond, Virginia journalism professor Shahan Mufti, his book, The Faithful Scribe. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now with the latest out of Hollywood. Joining me now for that is Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. Hi, Nicole. So I understand there's an update on the death of Star Wars actress Carrie Fisher.
The autopsy results for Carrie Fisher came back this week with toxicology results, and it said that she had several drugs in her system at the time of her death in December. It listed cocaine, methadone, alcohol, and opiates all in her system at that time. The coroner's report did say that she likely did cocaine up to 72 hours before her death. And fans will remember she suffered a heart attack on an airplane flying from London to Los Angeles and then was hospitalized and died 3 days later. Her daughter, Billie Lord, released a really nice statement, a very emotional statement about her. She said that her mother struggled with substance abuse and mental illness all of her life, and it ultimately led to her death. And she encouraged those who may be feeling unwell mentally to seek help, or maybe struggling with abuse, substance abuse problems themselves, to seek help and ask their local government for funding for mental health programs and substance abuse programs. And she ended it with "Love you, Mumby," which I guess was her nickname for her mother. So it was very sweet. And actually, Carrie Fisher was very vocal about her own struggles in her lifetime. She wrote a book about her mental illness as well as her drug abuse. And some fans may not know, but she actually was also buried in a Prozac pill-shaped urn, which was kind of a nod in her funny way, I guess, of making light of the situation and dealing with her mental health.
And then we've got some interesting, another little tidbit coming out about the, we as you reported a while back, American Idol coming back from the dead, so to speak, but on a new network, no longer on Fox, and now on ABC coming up in the fall. We're getting some clues as to another celebrity judge.
Yeah, it sounds like American Idol producers want to bring on Lionel Richie. He's being possibly approached by the producers because of his great success. I mean, he's a legend in the music industry. And also, he's very personable, which will play well on television. They already do have Katy Perry, and I'm hearing that they're still trying to nab Ryan Seacrest. I'm hearing that Ryan Seacrest is asking for between $10 and $15 million for a paycheck for American Idol, and Katy Perry is getting paid $25 million to be on the show. So I don't know if they'll be able to afford Lionel Richie. I don't know if he's asking for more or less or whatever. He hasn't even confirmed yet that he's or denied that he's been approached, but I know people are really looking forward to seeing who's going to be on the judges panel and what ABC will do differently from Fox.
All right. Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella, thanks for being with us. A new documentary looks back at 20 years of the career of multi-Grammy-winning rapper and producer Sean Diddy Combs. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, "Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A Bad Boy Story" commemorates Combs' rise to fame and his influence on hip-hop and rap.
Puff strikes me as the kind of kid who was hanging out with you and still thinking about the future.
I knew I wanted to be in the music industry.
He was making music that was making the ground shake.
Oh, Puff changed the whole thing.
Hit records after hit after hit after hit.
The film, directed by Daniel Kaufman, weaves together archival footage and new video to highlight Sean Diddy Combs' career. It shows the rise of Combs' Bad Boy label as a hip-hop powerhouse and culminates in the label's 20th anniversary tour in 2016. Diddy told the Associated Press that he felt the time was right to release the retrospective.
Yeah, I've been filming my life since I was 19, so like I felt we were going to make a movie one day out of the footage. And when this opportunity came about, it was more about us putting the show together. And, you know, a regular musical documentary. We didn't know it was going to be this, you know, this feature film that really got into our lives, the past, the present, and the future.
Combs said one reason for putting the movie out now is he wanted to make sure people who were not born or who were not familiar with what happened in the genre in the 1990s got a genuine look at it.
I just think that we're in a time right now where it's generational. So you have like three generations that are interested in this story. It's almost like when U2 got to a certain point, or the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, you know, it was important to like kind of tell that story for the generations that were catching up, that were there, that don't know about it. And, you know, I think that this was done in a way that it's more than just, it's kind of showing you a lot of things that you didn't know that you thought you knew.
It is always complicated. Greatness is complicated.
What the? I like God light. When God's light comes through,
my life don't work like that. I can make anything happen.
No disrespect, nobody's down with me.
Life has been an action movies, gangster films, romantic comedies, horror stories.
This film follows the success of two other films that look at the growth of rap and hip-hop in the 1990s, Straight Outta Compton about the rise of N.W.A., and All Eyes on Me about Tupac Shakur. Diddy says that he didn't want someone other than those involved telling his story.
You know, it's good to commemorate the history, especially after 20 years. And if you don't do it out here nowadays, because everybody, so into content, then another network or another company is going to do it and tell your story instead of you being involved in telling your own story.
Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A Bad Boy Story will be released on Apple Music June 25th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd. Alternate ending.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Pan American Development Foundation, known as PADF, celebrated the success of dozens of Haitian entrepreneurs supported by the LEAD program at a large exposition at the Caribe Hotel in Port-au-Prince earlier this month. Through the LEAD program, which stands for Leveraging Effective Application of Direct Investments, USAID has provided 45 Haitian and diaspora-led entrepreneurs with the capital and technical support needed to grow their business. Implemented by the PADF, the program supports long-term economic growth in the region. Each company was awarded a grant after successfully completing a business plan competition. Together, these enterprises have created more than 13,600 jobs in Haiti and are on track to create a total of 18,000 jobs by the end of the year. Since 2011, USAID's LEAD program has invested $7.4 million in businesses in various sectors of the Haitian economy, unlocking $12.7 million in private capital. LEAD has also delivered more than 10,000 hours of training to entrepreneurs to build their capacity and improve business operations. Together, LEAD-supported businesses, from the sanitary paper production plant to the solid waste processing plant, have generated nearly $28 million in sales. It's inspiring to be in a room with so many dynamic and creative Haitian entrepreneurs, said Nadia Cherouk, PADF country director. Their businesses are a testament to what can be achieved through hard work and persistence. Through LEAD, we are helping Haitians realize their business goals and creating a network of innovators. These entrepreneurs are paving the way to a more prosperous Haiti. The event included a business-to-business networking session to help the entrepreneurs forge important relationships with financial institutions, service providers, and sector experts. USAID's LEAD project aims to attract investments in Haiti's small and medium-sized enterprises and increase the development impact or remittances. We congratulate the entrepreneurs here today, said Brian Choucan, chargé d'affaires of the U.S. Embassy in Haiti. You are leaders of Haiti's new economy. The LEAD project's investment in these innovative entrepreneurs has unlocked millions in private capital. As their businesses grow, we anticipate that they will continue to attract financing from banks and equity investors, driving further economic development.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.